Bon, alors.
Cresson, école d'hiver 2020.
Le troisième jour de l'école d'hiver 2020, David Howes donne une conférence en anglais dans une ambiance tamisée et feutrée d'un amphi de l'ENSAG.
Bonsoir à tous. Je suis particulièrement heureux de recevoir David Howes, qui nous vient tout droit de Montréal et donc qui est professeur d'anthropologie à l'Université de Montréal et directeur du Centre d'études sur les Sensory Studies. Donc évidemment, vous comprenez bien que c'est un thème qui nous intéresse particulièrement, puisque au Cresson et le laboratoire sur les ambiances, le travail sur le son, le travail sur toutes les matières qui sont sensibilisées dans l'architecture, nous touche particulièrement. Donc c'est évidemment à partir de toute la littérature déjà produite par David Howes, qui résonne un petit peu avec nos préoccupations, que cette conférence entre en résonance en quelque sorte.
I want to say that it's a huge honor to be here in Grenoble, which is the birthplace of Cresson, on its 40th anniversary. This is in a way what I've been doing in Montreal parallels some of the things that have happened here. Because not only is this the birthplace of Cresson, but also in 2008, Jean-Paul Thibault founds the Ambience Network. And this is another major development in the field that I call sensory studies. And so, indeed, we've had Jean-Paul de Montreal once to give a very memorable talk, and now it's my chance to come here and to find out what's been going on in between the times that we had in Montreal and where things are now. Because I think there is a sensory revolution afoot, okay? That actually, sort of the turn to the senses, either in the form of sound or smell or touch, is part of a very widespread move in the humanities and social sciences, and it's very exciting, the new kinds of insights that this has generated. And if I can just situate that in a little bit more historical perspective, in the 1960s, there was the linguistic turn, okay? And then it was the idea that everything is structured, culture is structured like a language, and the idea of culture as a language game or culture as text was very prevalent in the humanities and social sciences. Then that was followed in the early 80s by the pictorial turn. And this was sort of a switch from, language to the image as being the focus of investigation. And that pictorial turn gives rise to visual culture studies, which is a booming industry that follows on from that. And then next in line, in the late 80s, early 90s, you have the material turn. And indeed, material culture studies becomes very important, and we begin to recognize that actually society is constituted as much by things as it is by people, and we have to recognize the agency of things, the agency of material. So these are all important correctives. And then in the 90s, later 90s, the turns start becoming more and more rapid. There's the affective turn. And there is also the sensory turn. And I think that, this series of turns is very interesting. And I think my feeling is that it culminates in the sensory turn. Indeed, the sensory turn is not just another turn, it's a revolution. Because the sensory turn takes in all the senses, all the faculties. So instead of the verbalism of the linguistic turn, and instead of the visualism of the pictorial turn, we try to attend to all of the senses and their interrelationship. And that is sort of the point of this kind of endeavor.
Are you saying that the medium is more important than the message it carries?
No. The medium is not more important than the message. It's obvious. The medium is the message.
I'd like to start, by just acknowledging my debt to Marshall McLuhan. And here you have the communications guru surrounded by different media, an illuminated manuscript, a typical text, telephones, and he has a pencil, I think, in his hand as well. And he, of course, introduced the idea of cultures as having different sensory ratios on account of the dominance of one or another mode of communication. So oral societies are ear-minded, literate societies are more visually minded, arguably. He thought that electronic communication is a form of touch, and so he thinks that the electronic age is an extension of the tactile. We'll come back to that. But it was actually attending a lecture that he gave at Trinity College in 1979, so also 40 years ago, that sparked in me this interest of looking into the ways in which we might understand cultures better through attending to the senses. In that regard, this is what led me to formulate an anthropology of the senses in a book called The Varieties of Sensory Experience, published in 1991. And that is part of the sensory turn in anthropology. There is also a sensory turn in history, a sensuous geography, a sociology of the senses. So all of these different disciplines have undergone this kind of turn. Now, the anthropology of the senses takes sort of the senses both as an object of study and as a means of inquiry. So we're both concerned to liberate the senses from psychologists. Okay? To me, our biggest enemy is psychology, because psychologists think that sensing goes on in the head and that it's an individual psychophysical process. And what the anthropology of the senses has showed instead is that it's a social process, a cultural action, as well as a physical one. And indeed, the ideas about the senses that we find in the West are not necessarily shared in other societies. For example, there's the long-standing notion of the nobility of sight being the highest of the senses in Western philosophy. But if you go to North Africa, you find traditions of the evil eye instead. And so sight is not so noble. Indeed, you have to avoid looking at people directly precisely because of a whole series of moral concerns about the immorality of sight. And so these kinds of shifts in the meaning and value of the senses are completely unknown to psychologists. And that's why, as anthropologists, as historians, as architects, we need to sort of take the study of the senses out of the laboratory and put it back into everyday life and begin to find out what happens in that kind of way. So the method of the anthropology of the senses is nicely defined by François Laplantin, who actually was a professor for many years at Lyon and the Université de Lumière. And Laplantin suggests in his book, in French, it's Le Social et Le Sensible, I had it translated into English, and we called it The Life of the Senses. And the reason for that is that the word sensible is a beautiful word, but it doesn't work in English. Okay? In English, sensible is sensible, like sensible shoes. Okay? And it has none of the connotations, none of the nuance of sensible. You're so fortunate to be working in French and have a word like sensible. Alain Corbin is called the historien du sensible. It's just so much richer than sensible, which is like common sense, which is not very interesting at all. So we couldn't call it the social and the sensible. We called it the life of the senses instead. And Laplantine suggested that the experience of ethnographic fieldwork is an experience of sharing in the sensible, partage du sensible. We observe, we listen, we speak with others, we partake of their cuisine. We try to feel along with them what they experience. We try to feel along with them what they experience. And this suggests to me a methodology of participant sensation, The typical anthropological method is one of participant observation. But I think that what Laplantine is suggesting is this idea of empathy, and therefore attempting at least to feel along with our research subjects. And in doing so, one of the things that we find is that the word sense is actually a very rich one. And in that regard, we need to actually understand what I would call its extra-linguistic as well as its linguistic references. The word sense, and sentir will go in this way as well, refers to both sensation and signification. It refers to both feeling and meaning, as when you speak of the sense of a word, le sens d'un mot. And here, that is a wonderful way in which meaning is no longer limited to language. Okay, that sensing is a process of both registering the world sensorially and finding meaning in it. And that is a crucial way in which we get beyond the linguistic turn with the sensory turn, a crucial way in which we actually begin to experience the world in all of its sensory plenitude. And so I'd like to just give you a couple of examples of sensory ethnography in action. And I'm going to draw, first of all, from some of my own research in Papua New Guinea. And I'd like to also discuss some of the work of my students so that we have an idea of what kinds of insights this methodology can yield. And then, in the latter part, I'd like to sort of go over some ways in which we've been experimenting with communicating the results of our research at the Center for Sensory Studies in Montreal, and then also bring out some of the implications for the field of design that would be of particular interest and relevance to you, perhaps. In 1990, so in that regard, 10, 11 years after McLuhan had planted the seed in my mind about going and studying the life of the senses in other societies, you know, asking, well, in an oral society where you have no writing, are people more ear-minded and are people more visually minded in a literate society? This seemed to me to be a pressing question. And so I went in 1990 with funding actually from the olfactory research over a number of months, was the Middle Sepik region, a town called Ambunti, which is actually sort of a place occupied by the Kwoma. You can see from this shot of a landing that this terrain consists of swampy marshlands and also a number of ridges. And the ridges are where the Kwoma actually build their houses. The ridges, the mountain ridges, are where they build their houses. And this is an example of the way in which the houses blend into the forest on these sort of inclines. And at the center, however, of each village is the men's house. Okay, and so the men's house is a very prominent architectural structure. And here you see an example from the village of Tongwinjam. And it is, in fact, really the center of a kind of men's culture, you could say. And it's also a center of civilization, because the Kwoma call themselves Kwoma, and it means mountain people. Okay? So they identify with the ridges in important ways. That is the sort of the scene of civilization. Another manifestation of ridges that is quite interesting and very pronounced in the culture is a tradition of scarification. So you also find people sort of actually use a knife and you pluck the skin and you rub ashes into it and you have this pattern of welts. This is a crocodile pattern, for example, and this is on both men and women, and it's understood to be a sign both of endurance, of fortitude, and of beauty. This is a totally staged photograph, and it shows why I am not a visual anthropologist. Really, I wanted to get this guy's back, and his back is totally covered in cicatrices, in scarification. And he told me that, indeed, his back was so fortified by this that if anybody stabbed him in a knife fight, he wouldn't feel a thing. Okay, so a pattern of ridges on the body as well, as a mark of both civilization and endurance. And then, just to actually bring it further, I'd like to exhibit this, and I'm going to pass it around so you'll actually get a feel for Kwoma society. This is a pendant, and it commemorated a feast, which was an exchange between two clans. And so this is a memento, but it's also a form of money. The number of these that you have in your possession is actually a sign of your wealth because of the number of exchanges, the number of gifts of food and other items you have made. And what's interesting is that these tiny kina shells are all sewn in ridges onto this pendant. And so in terms of geography, in terms of the body, and in terms of money, you have this sort of pattern of scarification. And I think that one really arrives at a feel for the culture through understanding this. So I'll put it in this net bag, but you're welcome to indeed actually touch sort of across a large area this manifestation of the sensory order of Kwoma culture. Now, apart from these pendants, a very significant component of Kwoma culture is all of the bark paintings and wood sculptures. And indeed, the Sepik River is one of the major art-producing centers of the world. And I was a little bit surprised, or you might be surprised, if you strictly follow McLuhan, how can there be so much emphasis on the visual in an oral society? But this is an example. You're looking up at the ceiling of one of those men's houses, and you're seeing all of the bark paintings, and you're seeing a sculpture going across. And this is a workshop where you have men engaged in producing these sculptures, just an endless ream of them, which are no longer used for ritual, but rather decorate boardrooms throughout Australia and New Zealand, because there's a real market for this so-called primitive art. And the men, in addition to being masters of the visual universe, because they are the only ones that make these paintings or carve and paint these sculptures, are masters of the acoustic universe, because through these, they're called slit gongs, they're large, long logs which have a cut in the middle, and they resonate with an extraordinary power when they are struck. And these are also in the men's house. And the time at which they are used especially is at the annual yam ceremony. And the yam ceremony is a time when a screen is constructed around the outside of the men's house, and the men create a terrific ruckus inside. And this is the voice of the spirits. The younger men, who are not initiated, and the women are outside, and they are led to believe that this is indeed the voice of the spirits. So the men know otherwise because they have had a visual revelation of who is really making these sounds. But the women and younger men are duped by their hearing into thinking that these are actually the sounds of the spirits. And they go along with this. No woman will admit to knowing what's really going on. And this is just because this is part of a socially agreed upon division of the senses. So men paint, and they also make noise. Women are engaged in other pursuits. Indeed, women, unlike the men, have to go down into the swamps each day. And when you go into the swamps, you can sink up to your knees in the mud. And there they fish. They also process sago, which is a kind of starch, by pounding a tree. It becomes a flour, and you can then mix it to make pancakes. The women otherwise are engaged in the sort of weaving of these net bags. So the women are not allowed to have any contact with the men, and they are not privy to the secrets of the visual universe, nor are they privy to the secrets of the acoustic universe. They are excluded. And in that regard, really, sight is the sense of knowing in Kwoma society. And interestingly, for an oral society, hearing is devalued. And indeed, the sign of a truly strong man in Kwoma society is one who sticks his tongue out like this. And that is a sign of power, and it's a sign of shouting down your opponents. Okay? So in Kwoma society, you don't listen. You never listen. You don't want to listen. You want to shout down your opponents. And having a strong and loud voice is very key. So my point is that we see that there's a division of geography on a sensory basis, the hard ridges, the soft and murky swamps. There's a division of the sexes, which is also has a sensory dimension. What is especially interesting is the way in which, it's a very fissive society, but the women weave it together through making these net bags, which they give to their partners and they give to various relatives. And so in spite of the way in which, seeing secrets divides, the women, weave the society together. And the women, it should be noted, have no space in the society otherwise. When they marry, they can only marry out of the village, so they always have to go to the village of their husband. And they're never really entirely comfortable there because they're amongst strangers, and there's all kinds of suspicions of their brothers amongst the men of the village they marry into about sorcery and so on. So were it not for the women doing all this weaving and gifting, there would be no sort of integration of Kwoma society whatsoever. So that's a sort of immersion, an initial immersion into the Kwoma society and the Kwoma sensory order. And the idea is that you need to learn how to sense along with them in order to arrive at important insights into their social and indeed their sensory world, or if you like, their sensory cosmology.
Cresson, école d'hiver 2020.
I'd like to present another case, which is by a friend of mine, Catherine Lynn Gertz, a book called Culture and the Senses, a book about the culture of the Anlo-Ewe of Ghana. And it's a very interesting account of an African society and the bodily ways of knowing in that society. There's a profound emphasis on balance, according to Gertz, in her account. So, for example, the fetus is imagined in the womb, seated on the placenta, already practicing the arts of balance. And then when a child is born from a very early age, their limbs are massaged, so they will be very supple, and so they will have the poise and grace that will enable them to be good dancers. And so that massage is so intense that some people can bend their elbows backwards, or appear to anyway. Now, don't try this. You can't. But through massage, okay, there are these techniques of massage that have actually sort of created this extraordinary suppleness in the body. The Anlo-Ewe have more than 50 words for different styles of walking. Okay, so they classify different ways of moving, different ways of walking, and have, like the proverbial Eskimo words for snow, 50 different terms. So one of these is kadza-kadza, which is to walk like a lion, okay, with majesty and with control. Another word is lugu-lugu, okay, and that is to weave back and forth like a drunkard. And Catherine described how she was constantly hearing mothers calling out to their children, "Don't you lugu lugu." Okay, so trying to get them to walk properly, because all kinds of inferences were drawn about their character based on the way in which they walked. Okay, so it was important to walk the right walk if you wanted to be seen as a stable, a dependable, an honorable member of the society. And in that regard, there's a whole morality of walking. Now, we too have different ways of walking, and you can see variations across cultures, but we don't have, I think, anything like that kind of sensitivity to ways of walking, ways of moving, and the idea of balance that is so key to the Anglo-Ewe. Another manifestation of this concern with balance is that they have a way of transporting things which involves head loading, which leaves the hands free. But again, head loading, even trying to carry a book on your head, it takes a great deal of practice and skill, and so represents a technique of the body that is very particular to actually many cultures in Africa and elsewhere, but it's especially prominent amongst the Anglo-Ewe. The two last facts about the Anglo-Ewe, and again, I think that this sort of trying to feel along with them helps one arrive at a more nuanced interpretation and understanding, or an empathic feeling for their culture. They are a group that migrated into Ghana from elsewhere, and they have constantly been persecuted. And in that regard, what's remarkable is how successful they have been, both in Ghana and elsewhere, in occupying important positions in the government. And this success is actually attributed to their flexibility, their bodily flexibility, which also involves a kind of mental flexibility. And indeed, their success, or the secret of their success, is encapsulated in a proverb which goes, "If you visit the village of the toads and find them squatting, you must squat too." Okay? So in other words, you adapt your way of moving to the other groups around you. And in this way, you can actually end up in a position of power, in effect, as they have. One last point. The Anglo-Ewe, as I said, moved into the area of Ghana. They migrated there from elsewhere. And in their foundation myth, it tells of an ancestor who just collapsed at the point, which is now the center of Anglo-Ewe territory. So he just collapsed, and he sort of rolled up into himself. And this is actually the meaning of the name Anglo as well. And when you pronounce it, you can feel how your mouth sort of curves inward as well. Anglo. Okay, there's a kind of resonance there as well. So both in this sort of prototypical gesture of the ancestor who collapses and rolls in, and in the way in which you say the Anglo name, you find this manifestation of a certain curling inwards. But it was pointed out by one of Catherine's sort of informants that also at times, the Anglo-Ewe get up. Okay, and that's that feeling of unfolding as well, which is also part of the identity. So I hope I've given you a bit of a feel for the Anglo-Ewe sensory order as well. And now I'd like to present very briefly a study done by one of my students, Mark Dirksen. He defended his thesis in 2018, and it was a thesis about a very unusual subculture, which is actually not only found in North America, especially in California, it's also found in the UK and elsewhere. And they call themselves grinders. What they do is that they are not satisfied with the standard allotment of five senses. Okay, they just don't think that's sufficient. And they want, especially, to enjoy a magnetic sense that birds have, but we don't. And to that end, they implant magnets in their fingers, and then these actually pick up on electromagnetic waves in the environment. Now, no doctor is going to do this to you. No doctor is going to sort of put a little battery, a little magnet under your skin. So it's all DIY. They do it themselves. And there are all kinds of unfortunate consequences that come from it. But what's remarkable is that, sort of like the X-Men, they acquire this supersensory power as compared to us ordinary mortals. Okay? And Mark had these implants himself during the period of his research. Now, one of the problems is that, you know, we have a language of colors, we have a language of sounds, and so forth. We don't have a language for talking about electromagnetic vibrations. It just doesn't exist. So how do you do research with people that are picking up on these other frequencies? Well, that's why he had to have the implants himself. But he also talked with people and indeed had it's a wonderful ethnography for all of the accounts that he was able to acquire. And so let me just read you one, which has to do with a trash compacting machine. Now, you might not think these are very interesting devices, but listen to this, okay? This is Zach. Zach says, "The favorite thing I've ever felt was actually during when I had my first implant. So it was still super fresh, not really sensitive. But at my old job, we had this trash compactor in the back of the store. And every time I would take out the trash, just walking into the vicinity, I would get this buzz. I like to say it feels like you're walking around this super powerful object, but I mean, really, you are. That is what you're feeling because there's so much electricity going through that, as if it were some mystical artifact or something that was the energies emanating from it. I haven't yet, but I still want to go back now that I have a fully healed one on my finger just to see what it feels like at peak sensitivity. I think that's my favorite thing." They've collected all these, you know, favorite sensations that they encounter in various ways. And some of those sensations are really quite interesting. Like, for example, in older buildings, they spoke of how it was possible to feel where poorly shielded electric lines would whisper or leak through the walls. So it'd be like, you know, looking at a wall and seeing a water stain. What they would feel in place of a water stain is this tingling sensation from the poorly sealed electrical wires there. And they also sort of were really struck, many of them, by the feeling they had when they entered banks. They talked about a 5 foot high wall of electromagnetic force that they encountered, perhaps as part of a security system, perhaps not. But what was interesting is that in this way, they became aware of all the ways in which we are surveyed, okay, not just visually, but electronically. And they were sensitive to these things and a little bit paranoid as a result of this heightened sensitivity. One of the things that Mark himself found was that, you know, he was reminded of this every time he exited the library, because every time he went out, the scanners looking for books that are hidden, you know, would pick up and would resonate with his magnets. But he also knew when the system was down. And so we don't know how many books he stole from the Concordia Library. He never owned up to having stolen even one. He probably didn't. But the point was there were advantages to this form of sensation as well. So this is an extreme example of actually experimenting with a sixth sense and actually acquiring it oneself in order to be able to follow the life world, the sensory life of this very interesting North American subculture. And they do many other things as well. They experiment wildly with drugs. They drink all kinds of carrot juice to try and improve their eyesight so they can see into the infrared. This is completely disproven. It doesn't happen. But they are constantly trying to expand the bounds of sense. And you know, they think of themselves as a cut above the rest of us, because we've just got five senses, they have six. Another one of my students is currently in Oslo, in Norway. And her name is Roselyne Lambert, is engaged in a very interesting study of agoraphobia. And she herself suffered from agoraphobia as a teen. So from the age of 12 to 14, she basically didn't go out of her house. And she reflected on this experience, and it became the topic of her master's degree. And now, after 10 years as a researcher, she's coming back to do her PhD. And in the time, she has blossomed as a poet. And so she actually has funding both from the Social Science and Humanities Research Council and the Conseil des Arts in Quebec. She is a poet anthropologist. What a wonderful identity, you know, to mix poetry in with the way in which you do anthropology. So again, she had a personal experience with agoraphobia and did a study of it for her master's, and now she is doing so for her PhD. And she went to Oslo to study this because Norway has the highest incidence of agoraphobia in the world. What is more, the most famous agoraphobe of all time is Edvard Munch. We all know The Scream. And in that regard, she is living in the quarter where Edvard Munch lived for the last 30 years of his life in almost total seclusion. Now, Munch, agoraphobia is understood as a fear of public space. What his paintings are famous for is for their exposure of an inner sense. You know, they are painted from the inside. They are not just representations of an outside kind of world. But here, she is studying both his legacy and she is studying through sometimes going on walks with people who have agoraphobia, but just as often only conversing with them through Skype or social media. So she does both means for studying this and has been studying the culture of Norway through this lens. And one of the interesting things that she found was that people in Norway talk about the light the way other people talk about the weather. Okay? So whereas the weather is a constant topic of conversation amongst ourselves, in Norway it's the qualities of the light, because light is so precious, especially in the winter. And so she wants to be there for a year, and she is going to be there for a year, in order to experience all the different gradations of light throughout the calendar and try to work out, you know, what kind of effect that might have as well on people's psyches. She's exploring the colors of light, and she's exploring various ways in which people have indeed experienced agoraphobia, and she's as much concerned with their own constructions of it. So I think agoraphobia is of intense interest to us in urbanism and architecture because it's supposedly a fear of public space. She's finding different things going on. And one of the things that she's looking at is, for example, objects that contain space, like windows, for example. She's found a very interesting and elaborate discourse around windows, and windows do actually, they're objects that contain space that she's trying to work through with her her various subjects.
École d'hiver 2020.
So those are four examples of anthropology of the senses in action, and there are many more I'd be happy to share with you. But what I'd like to do now is actually turn to talk a little bit about the institutional setting for this research. It is all research being done by people who are members of the Center for Sensory Studies. And that center, it began as a research team called the Concordia Sensoria Research Team back in 1988. We did a whole series of projects, but then we got faculty recognition in 2012 and university recognition in 2016. And so now we are a university-recognized research center, which comes with a nice budget. You have $25,000, which you can use to sort of promote various initiatives. One of those is the Sensory Studies website, which parallels the Ambience website in a very interesting way. Indeed, they're very complementary. And so the Sensory Studies website is a place where we announce books of note, events of note. We publish articles, and we also have various sort of forms of exchange. This is all done. This is all students from the center who curate that particular website. So that is the institutional structure. And there are about 30 students attached to the center and 19 faculty. And so we have one token psychologist, our whipping boy. We are always criticizing him and his discipline for the way in which they, as far as we're concerned, distort the study of the senses. But he's actually a very capable individual, and he's resisting us forcefully, and we have a deep respect for his views as well. Otherwise, we consist of anthropologists, historians like Constance Klassen, sociologists like Anthony Sinnott, who's now retired, art historians, people from design and communication studies. So it really is, much like Ambiance, the network, a multidisciplinary group. And we are now bringing in affiliates from other universities, but what was remarkable was that we had so much concentration in Concordia itself to be able to get, you know, a core of projects going. So there are 19 faculty members and about 30 students. Every year, about 5 come in and 5 graduate. And because we have an interdisciplinary degree program at Concordia, the PhD in Humanities, they can do sensory studies as their concentration. There are a series of different axes that we explore, and I'm not going to go into all of them, but one of those is sensory legal studies. And so this reflects partly the fact that I have 2 law degrees as well as some degrees in anthropology, and I've tried to cross legal studies and sensory studies, and what we came up with was this idea of sensory legal studies. And in fact, the senses have a very distinctive role to play in law. There is the law of evidence, for example, which frequently insists on eyewitness testimony, which rejects hearsay, and which has real problems with smell, because smell is sort of seen as a suspect sense. So even when, you know, can you identify a person on the basis of their smell? And, you know, dogs are supposedly capable of doing this, but how trustworthy is that? So all kinds of issues about the trustworthiness of the senses in the law of evidence. Also the law of nuisance. You know, what is olfactory pollution? What is sound pollution? A huge area. But lawyers weren't thinking about the fact that this is a sensory dimension they have to look at. And so I think that, you know, through anthropology, through history, we can enrich the understanding of sort of, you know, what kind of evidence should be presented in cases of nuisance violations. And another very interesting area is property in the senses. And this is the domain of intellectual property. And the question is, you know, trademarks. Now, it used to be that a trademark was a name, and it could also be a logo, like IBM. But what's happened in recent years is that there's been an explosion in the trademarking of colors. And so here you see 3 cases of, you know, the use or the appropriation of these colors by, in the top line, a soft drink manufacturer, an airline, and a kind of Virgin Records and so forth, a media company. So here, they can each use the color red, and it's the same hue, because they are in different fields, so they're not competing. But otherwise, if Pepsi were to use the same red to advertise itself, then it would be committing an infringement on the Coca-Cola trademark. And this would confuse potential customers, and therefore the Coca-Cola lawyers would be all over the Pepsi people in order to protect what's called the goodwill that inheres in that color. Now, you know, what's interesting is that as a result, the divisions of the color spectrum are being privatized. You might have thought that colors are just out there. You know, how can they be privatized? But this is an example of just that. There is property in colors. And there is also now property in sounds. You know, think of the sound when your computer opens up. There is property in sense. Every sensation has been commodified and used to push merchandise. And so this is seen as progressive. Okay? It's seen by lawyers as progressive, the fact that you can have all these different domains for trademarking sensations. But But I'm reminded of a Peruvian folktale, which comes from peasants, and I think they see the wisdom, you can see the wisdom that they have. And it's the story of a baker who brought his neighbor to court for stealing the smell of his buns. Okay? And so he brought his case before the court that, you know, this fellow was stealing the smell. And the judge agreed with him, there was a theft, and that it should be recompensed by the neighbor jingling coins. Okay? So, you know, one sensation should be repaid with another sensation, but there's not capital, there's not property in sensation. That's ridiculous. But, you know, trademark lawyers think it's, you know, it's the thing. And so we're trying to correct them. And that's the way in which sensory studies is very much a critical practice at the same time as it is a sensory one. And building on that, another domain that we have been exploring is what we call sensory museology. And sensory museology is, first of all, the study of the history of museums. What kind of display practices have they used over time? And you find that in the early museum, the 16th and 17th century, people were hefting things, they were smelling them, they were chewing on them. You know, not something you can do now. Indeed, now the rule in the museum is do not touch. And so how do we get from the early museum, which was a kind of sensory gymnasium, you used all your senses, to the museum of today, which is purely for the sight? But actually there's changes now going on in museums, which have to do with interactive displays, and there are quite a number of very interesting experiments. Like, for example, 2 years ago at the National Gallery in London, six paintings were chosen, and sort of musicians, sound artists, were invited in to compose a soundscape for each of those paintings. And so you went and you stood before the painting, and you could actually hear the picture by putting on headphones. And the idea was that this would augment your enjoyment, augment your appreciation for the work as a result of multiplying the senses engaged. And so, you know, sort of the idea of unimodal art, visual art, or sound art, or this kind of thing is increasingly getting eclipsed by a kind of emphasis on an art of a multimodal kind of nature. Another example of some of the research that we've done under this heading has to do with Marie-Pierre Gadoua, and she did a study at the McCord Museum in Montreal. It's a museum of Canadian history where there is an extensive collection of Eskimo, or rather Inuit, artifacts. And what she was able to do was to negotiate with the director of the museum to enable people, Inuit men and women, to actually touch the objects, to handle them. And this is very interesting. It happened, or the people that were, you know, sort of enabled to do this were people who were in Montreal, frequently for medical reasons, receiving treatment. And often they can lose their way in a big, booming city like Montreal. This was found to ground them. So going into the museum and being permitted to actually touch their own heritage was a way in which they connected with their past. And it was an important source of cultural pride for them, because they marveled at the ingenuity of their ancestors. And as a result of being able to manipulate these things, they came up with uses for some of the artifacts that the curators had no idea of. So actually, this is all filmed, and now it's part of the exhibition, demonstrating uses for things that the curators, being outsiders, had no notion of. And this is a sort of, by sort of enabling touch in the museum instead of prohibiting it, you know, opening up other ways of understanding, other possibilities of understanding. So we have, in the past, created what we call performative sensory environments, which are unlike museums because they don't have objects. They just consist of sensations. And this has been a way of enabling people to step outside of Western culture and into other cultures, if only momentarily. So we've done this for a series of different sort of examples, one based or inspired by the Tzotzil of Mexico, another by the Desana of Colombia, I can give you information about those. But in our current project, what we are doing is actually allying ourselves with Indigenous artists in both Canada and Australia, and creating multimodal artwork that crosses cultural barriers, okay, that actually is able to communicate at the level of the senses across cultural barriers. And so what I'm going to do is just play this once for you, and then I'd like to interpret it with you. Okay, so this is a work by a Cree artist, Cheryl Lirondel. Cheryl has here created an intercultural, intersensory work of art, in that it happens on, you know, sort of in a park in Toronto on a December eve. And she has sent out a call, and people have come, members of the dominant society, of white society. And when they get to this park, first of all, they light sage bundles. So there is this wonderful aromatic smoke that billows. And then they are handed flashlights, and they form a teepee, with the beams of the flashlights. So that, in effect, they create a kind of ephemeral structure, which you could describe as light art, but it's more than that, because there is an olfactory dimension, so they smell the sage, which has all kinds of meanings, sacred and otherwise, in Indigenous culture. And also, they all have to stand in a particular way to hold the beams of the flashlight. So there's a kinesthetic, proprioceptive dimension as well. And these are members of the dominant society. I mean, one of the people there, the man in the suit, is actually the mayor of Toronto. Okay, so what's interesting about this as part of an exercise in communicating across cultural boundaries is that this light teepee takes shape, and it's against the backdrop of the settler city of Toronto, but it rivals it in its splendor and its olfactory richness for that brief moment. And also, she is sort of in some ways bending these members of the dominant society to an Indigenous will as a result of sort of having them assume these postures. I think it's a very exciting work, and it's typical of the work that a number of the Aboriginal artists, both from Canada and Australia, have been doing. My task is to interview people after they've been through one of these experiences and try and draw out the lessons. I'm going to wrap up in the next 5 minutes by just talking about some of our current research. And this is actually bringing us close to the wonderful work that is being done here at Ambiance. And indeed, where we're heading now owes a great deal to Jean-Paul's editing and overseeing of the translation of an extraordinary book, The Aesthetics of Atmosphere, by the German phenomenological philosopher Gernot Böhme. This idea of atmosphere is a very powerful one, and I think it's absolutely central to doing architecture, and I'll come back to that in a moment. I above all like the idea of atmosphere that is elaborated over the course of the book, and I have my copy with me, because it's an alternative to the idea of affordance. You know, the idea of affordance is very popular in design. It comes from the work of J.J. Gibson, an environmental psychologist, and it's the idea that the affordance is sort of a certain possibilities of action that are created by certain features of the environment. So, for example, this chair is an affordance. It affords the possibility of sitting. And designers love that because they can create affordances. They can dictate how people will behave, even though the idea that Gibson had was the idea of, he's talking about, you know, the senses as mobile and active and so forth. But, you know, the idea of affordance is actually, again, loved by designers because they create forms that you then fit. But if you come from an Asian culture, you might squat on the chair. Okay? If you were in the 19th century, if you were a daughter going by the chair that your father usually sat in, you would curtsy before it. There are all these other meanings and practices around chairs that designers are often oblivious to, but which we see manifested across cultures. And this is why the idea of atmosphere is so much preferable, because the idea of atmosphere, I want to suggest, is an interactive one and not the kind of dictatorial one that affordance is. I should say one more thing. J.J. Gibson worked out his theory of perception in the context of doing research on how to enable fighter pilots to land planes safely. Okay? So it's military research. Maybe there's nothing wrong with that. And it works for vision. I don't think that his ideas about how the senses function work for other senses. And more than that, I don't think the senses are just like drones. Okay? There are all kinds of ways in which the senses are hedged in. And Gibson is ignorant of that. Why? He's a psychologist. What do you expect? Sorry. I shouldn't have said that. But the idea of affordance that we get from Boma is of atmosphere that we get from Boma is so much richer. Atmosphere is what relates objective factors and constellations of the environment with my bodily feeling in that environment. Okay? So, in other words, the idea of atmosphere is about what is in between. So not just the affordance, but what is in between a subject and an object. What mediates the two sides. And atmospheres, he says, are quasi-objective because they are out there and you can enter an atmosphere, but they are not things, okay, because actually they are nothing without a subject actually feeling them. And so, you know, again, the power of this idea of an interactive relationship between subjects and objects, or you know, perceivers and the built environment, is, I think, a tremendously powerful one. And, you know, furthermore, you know, there's a very strong dimension having to do with moods and affects in the literature on atmosphere. In that regard, it's attuned to the emotional or affective side, as well as the material side. And I guess that what I want to emphasize is the importance of looking at sensory atmospheres. And so in a project we've just applied for to two different granting agencies called Explorations in Sensory Design, we are forming teams and going, we've done some pilot studies, to practice sensory ethnography in a series of different public spaces, the casino, the hospital, the hotel, the park, and the tourist information center. And so what we are doing is using this methodology to actually feel along with people who visit those places what they're all about. And in this regard, we are trying to augment, in a good way, the practice of sensory design. So right now, sensory design, it was the topic of a major exhibition at the Cooper Hewitt in New York in 2018, called The Senses, Design Beyond Vision. It was a wonderful exhibition. One of the installations was a huge, looked like a synthetic fur, and as you moved your hand over it and created patterns, they became sounds. Okay? Another one had these large wooden balls, and you could put your head in them and move, and it would massage your head in quite an extraordinary manner. And, you know, sort of the most common example of sensory design is actually traffic signals for the blind, okay, the beeping sound, which enables them to navigate. And so it's very much sensory design is about being inclusive, incorporating the blind, incorporating the deaf. We want to take it that much further by actually having something in sensory design for minorities as well, other minorities, ethnic minorities. And it's in that regard that we are pursuing this whole series of projects in different spaces. I'd love to talk about the casino, because the casino is very interesting. What they are doing to your senses is quite shocking, too. But let me just end with a quote from Boehme again in The Aesthetics of Atmosphere, where he talks about how architecture and design have always produced atmospheres, but the thinking about architecture mainly concentrated on buildings and the visual representation and thinking and their visual representation, and thinking about design concentrated on the form or shape of things. Now we're in an age when buildings and also commodities are designed for multiple senses. They have to have not just the right look, but also the right feel, the right sound, the right smell. Truly, a sensorial revolution is at hand. Let me close on that note. Thank you for your attention. Et maintenant, on peut parler en français, on peut alors prendre certaines de ces idées et alors explorer les implications pour l'élaboration d'une architecture sonore, d'une architecture multisensorielle, et aussi l'exploration des espaces urbains d'une manière beaucoup plus sensible, et alors la création des environnements qui sont plus inclusifs, mais à cause de leur multisensorialité, au lieu de les uniformités de modernisme en architecture, par exemple. J'ouvre la forme.